Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
All right, so why did boys in old photographs wear dresses? I found out why this past week. Hi, it's Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and you have found America's family history show, Extreme Genes, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. I'll tell you about the boys in the dresses in a minute. This month is our first anniversary. So many people have had a tremendous part in getting this show up and running, beginning with you, our listeners, and I thank you so much. Tom Perry, our preservation authority, has been here since day one. Ryan Bennett, who works behind the scenes doing incredible stuff. Rod Arquette, who brought some great ideas to the table. I mean, literally, he's a well-known radio programmer, and I took him to lunch. And then he paid for the lunch. Skip Jokel, our syndication representative at Talk Shows USA. Fred Holland, the first programmer to pick us up in syndication at WTKI and WEKI in Alabama. And there are many more. I'll likely offend by not mentioning them. I guess I'd better mention my wife, Julie, who actually believed we could syndicate a radio show on family history. Thanks also to all our sponsors. Please give them your support. Each one has amazing products that I totally believe in. They are most worthy of your patronage. Well, this week, we're going to help you find out about your Revolutionary War ancestors. Craig Scott, CEO of Heritage Books, will be here in about 7 minutes. He's written a book called Genealogy at a Glance, Revolutionary War Genealogy Research. It's amazing how much you can learn about your patriots and their roles in helping us gain our independence and liberty. And we'll have some very cool stories mixed in there, too. Later in the show, listener Suzanne Anderson talks about her search for her husband's grandparents who followed America's beacon and escaped a life they wouldn't even talk about in Russia. A few years before that country's own so-called revolution. We'd love hearing your stories and how you found them. And, of course, my friend Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, who just got married last week, will be in to talk about a new type of camcorder that will allow you to get footage in a place that couldn't be got not all that long ago. All right, the boys in the dresses, particularly the long-haired ones. I had wondered about this myself. I've seen many 19th century and early 20th century photos with pictures of little boys in dresses. My wife's grandfather and one of my dad's cousins, just in my family. The other day, I was with our photo expert, Ron Fox, in the presence of another photograph history buff, and we were talking daguerreotypes when he showed us an amazing detailed picture of a little girl from the 1860s that was sitting on his desk. At least, I thought it was a little girl. I asked him if he knew who she was, and he said, no, but it's a he. And I laughed and said, well, how would you know that? I mean, the child's hair was long, the dress was beautifully feminine, and he said, the hair. Well, I couldn't figure out how that would reveal anything. And then he explained, back in the day, boys wore dresses until they were potty trained. It was too difficult to slip in and out of the pants of those times, so they wore dresses. And so that they would be recognized as boys, their hair was parted on one side, the other side, or both. And the girls had their hair parted down the middle only. Amazing. And that's why little boys wore dresses and how you can tell they're boys or girls. I've posted a couple of photos of these 19th century long-haired boys in dresses on our website, extremejeans.com. And it is time once again for this week's Family Histoire News from the pages of extremejeans.com. Terrence Lavin, writing in the New York Times, has written a fascinating, and I mean fascinating, piece about investigating his second great-grandfather, Patrick, a New York City policeman who in 1889 was indicted for murder. Lavin found the article on the situation while searching the New York Times archives. Love those digitized newspapers. Well, that led Terrence to dig deeper. Terrence learned that this wasn't the first time his law-enforcing ancestor had killed someone. The first occasion came in 1887 when Officer Lavin confronted a belligerent and drunk Irish immigrant named Thomas Moore. Friends convinced Lavin not to arrest Moore, that he was harmless but erratic. But a week later, Lavin came upon a fight involving Moore and told the man to go home. Well, an hour later, Moore attacked Lavin and stabbed him in the chest. The officer drew his gun and shot Moore four times and attacked his head with his club. Moore died while Lavin survived his very serious chest wound. Then in 1889, in a complicated story involving officer payoffs and liquor being illegally served on a Sunday, Lavin, who was out of uniform, was attacked by a German janitor at a bar that was illegally opened. Lavin used his club to defend himself and struck the man, Caspar Faust, numerous times until he died. It was ruled that Lavin was justified in the killing, self-defense, but German Americans were incensed at what had happened. Terence Lavin had known very little of his great-great-grandfather until his research revealed this story. Then, with further effort, he contacted a descendant of Faust in Long Island. The two later met at the very spot where Lavin's ancestor had killed Stephen Faust's ancestor in New York City. Stephen had never heard the story either. It's an amazing article with lots more details. Find the link at extremejeans.com. The Sacramento Bee is carrying an awesome article on something I've been thinking about a lot lately, especially since my recent find of old family Bible records and daguerreotype photos. How to leave your treasured family items to the next generation and when, or what to do if you suddenly come into possession of your deceased relative's possessions, treasures and otherwise. How do you handle what to keep and what to get rid of? There's far too much advice for me to properly review here, but it's a topic we all need to consider sooner than later, whether you're about to go through the loss of a loved one or anticipate the day you leave this world. You're going to want to read this story. Find the link at extremejeans.com. And coming up next, Craig Scott of Heritage Books joins us in 3 minutes to give you some ideas on what you can learn about those ancestors of yours in the three-cornered hats on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And on the line with us right now from Rocky Mount, North Carolina, is Craig Scott. He is the CEO of Heritage Books and also the writer of Genealogy at a Glance, Revolutionary War Genealogy Research. And this is a great weekend to talk about it. Hi, Craig. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
You've been obviously digging into this for a long time because you have those two little initials after your name, which tells us that you're really smart. And how would somebody go about starting their research into a Revolutionary War ancestor?
I think the first thing that you need to do is to talk to your parents, if they're still around, or any aunt that's in the DAR and any uncle that's in the FAR. Most folk have those kind of people hanging around. I know I did. Unfortunately, the ancestor that she went in, my aunt went in under, wasn't one that I cared about. It was a collateral line, not one that helped me. But I always start with family and see what family has to say and then go prove them right or prove them wrong. And then after that, there's a subscription service out there called Fold 3.
Yes, Fold 3 is great.
It is the most magnificent source for Revolutionary War materials. The pensions are there. The compiled military service records are there. And I'd recommend you start looking for a pension and see if you can find a pension, because they're full of genealogical information, and it's more likely that you can connect to a person with a pension whose family you know. Because obviously you should know the child of this Revolutionary War soldier if
right.
you didn't know the Revolutionary War soldier. And then from there, the pension will tell you what unit they belong to, and then you can go after the compiled military service records.
And I'll tell you, the pension records are fabulous and can be incredible with some of the things in there, because there was always the issue all these years after the war where they had to prove that they had been in the Revolution, and since a lot of records were missing, they had to explain their service or explain their relationship within the family. I've seen family Bible records in there, found all kinds of great stories in there relating to their service, and I'm sure you have too, Craig.
Sure. In fact, the case of an ancestor, William E. Brockett, a major in the South Carolina militia who has a pension, who has a Bible record in the pension. And that Bible record is actually a photostatic copy, reverse photostatic copy, which means that that was not the original submitted with the pension. What happened is long after the Civil War and before World War One, they began returning pieces of the pensions to people. So the original Bible record went back to the family. I don't know where it went back to the family, but it went back to somebody.
So you found a photocopy of it at some point.
Right.
And so you knew it still existed out there. Well, the ones we found, now my wife had one, a guy named Caleb Witt. He was from Virginia, and he wound up at the Battle of Yorktown. Since he was gone and it was his widow applying for it, there were all kinds of stories from various witnesses who knew his connection to that particular aspect of his service that has really made for some colorful history for us.
Well, there are two things that had to be proved. The service had to be proved and the marriage had to be proved. And widows would get pensions. The acts that made widows eligible were, until 1855, a function of when they married the soldier. So, for example, the 1836 Act, she had to be married to the soldier before the expiration of his enlistment.
Mm-hmm.
And as pension acts continued, they moved that date to 1800, and then eventually they removed the marriage date.
Hey, let me ask you about that, because
the widows outlasted the soldiers. The last soldier died in about 1867.
But the last widow went quite a bit longer.
Doesn't die. I don't think. I'm not sure of this, but the 1920s.
Really? So back in the day, there were no vital records. I mean, New York didn't start keeping track, for instance, of marriages until long after the Revolution.
This depends on how you define vital records. I mean, there's still marriage licenses. There's still marriage bonds. There's still things to relate to things that we call vital records. I mean, there's still marriage records. They may not be state-sanctioned or state-required, a.k.a. vital records, but there's still ways to track down marriage.
I understand that, but the question would be, in the case of a widow applying for a pension, wouldn't there be some concern by the government that she was fraudulently creating? I mean, basically, the Bible records were accepted as proof, were they not?
In addition to two people being present at the wedding.
Ah, okay.
The affidavits from people present at the wedding.
Got it. Okay. So that was where the proof had to come from, so everybody had to swear to it.
Right.
Now, I had a revolutionary ancestor named Samuel Pease, who was out of Freehold, New Jersey. He was in the Battle of Monmouth, and he died in 1814, and his widow lived until 1853. And she applied, and it was very interesting, Craig, because she used some lawyers to help her, and it was quite a battle to finally get the money, the back money that was owed to her. But these guys had all kinds of different stories and units and attributed various memories to her of what units he said he belonged to. And when I got into that, I found that Samuel Pease had somebody who lived nearby named Samuel Pierce, spelled very similarly. And it looked like the lawyers were actually trying to basically increase the amount of money she got by combining the records of Samuel Pease with Samuel Pierce. Do we see this kind of thing a lot?
I don't think it happens a lot, but it happens. It does happen. Does it happen every single time? No. Is the government on the lookout for that kind of stuff? Yeah, they recognize the fraud exists. The proofs have to be pretty clear in regards to the affidavits. And if they have a question, they might send a pension examiner out to interview the neighbors and that kind of thing.
Now, they actually had a statement from a neighbor who had fought with Samuel Pierce, who I believe, you know, he thought it was somebody else he was giving the testimony for. And it were great stories from the Revolutionary War, but I'm thinking, well, that doesn't really apply to my guy, because when I got into what unit he was serving in, we found it was a very different person. Did the lawyers make more money from their clients if they were able to get more on their behalf?
It depends on the time frame that you're talking about when they're actually doing it. In a lot of cases, there were laws in place that established what the fee could be, and it couldn't be in excess of that. So it just really depends what law is in effect at the time.
I was just trying to figure out what their motivation was to create this monstrous file of information that included more of Samuel Pierce than my Samuel Pease.
Probably wanted to get somebody off the rolls. In a lot of places, those widows are, in fact, being supported by the county.
Oh.
Because they have no visible means of support. And all of a sudden, getting $8 a month could be useful.
Sure. And so you're saying maybe the county wanted to push that along.
Right. You know, there's also the point that there isn't just the pension that is full of all this information. One of the untapped sources is the payment vouchers and the last and final payments, where every 6 months, March and September is when it happened, someone would present themselves to a bank that was a pension agency. Most of the pension agencies were pension agents, were bankers, and pension agencies were in banks because they had vaults to protect the government's money. So in March and September, either the pensioner or a person with their power of attorney and a copy of their pension certificate would show up at the pension agency and they'd be paid. So they would get a receipt and the money, and then a payment voucher would be filled out. And quarterly, the pension agents would send these back to D.C., and they would end up in the pension ledgers, and those ledgers are on Ancestry, so they're readily accessible. And each one of those tick marks for the quarter, 1, 2, 3, or 4, identify when the individual came in and got their pension payment. If the pension payment occurred after the death of the pensioner, then they're also full of genealogical information because it's the heirs coming in to get the payment. So the heirs are being specifically identified, whereas you may not find children identified in the pension.
Right, yes.
In fact, I know of cases, Hedgman Triplett of Franklin County, Kentucky, originally of Culpeper County, Virginia, has 8 kids, and only one child was identified in the pension by name, Polly Clements. But in the final payments, after he's dead, all 8 of the children are identified. And in the case of Lucy Palmer, who predeceases Hedgman Triplett, all of her children are identified. So what you have is all 8 children, who their spouses are if they're females, and then Lucy Palmer's children because she's predeceased. So it's a gold mine compared to the pension itself.
And then, of course, all this can lead you back to the unit, and then researching the unit itself and where they served and where they fought can become a whole other line of research.
It can. One of the real problems is the confusion that goes on in the table of organization of Washington's Army. It is very fluid, and so what may be true one day is not true 6 months later in regards to units and those kind of things and who they belong to, what brigade they belong to. And regiments may start out as larger entities and then all of a sudden shrink down to very small entities. There are some unit histories, but not very many. For example, we have a unit history on the 1st Virginia, a unit history on the 3rd Virginia, I think the 1st New York. There just aren't that many out there. You have to actually get into the muster rolls and look at the headers of the muster rolls and see where they say they are at that point in time, every 2 months.
He's Craig Scott. He's from Rocky Mount, North Carolina. He's the author of Genealogy at a Glance, Revolutionary War Genealogy Research. And, boy, it's very helpful, Craig. Any other thoughts, by the way, for people getting into this?
Don't stop too soon.
Well, that's good. That's good advice for anything, isn't it?
It is, but it never fails. So once you may think you found it all, always remember that, especially if it's a militiaman, he can serve in more than one unit in the war. You have to look in multiple places, not just Fold 3. You may have to look in state archives, state historical societies, county historical societies to ferret out the information. It's not all in one place. There's always more than you think there is.
Well, you know, that is great advice. And thank you so much for your time, Craig. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
My pleasure.
And on the way next, of course, the Revolution was just a part of America's story. Many immigrants have carved a very unique place in our history. Listener Suzanne Anderson tracked down the story of her husband's grandparents, and wait till you hear what she discovered. It's coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with my guest, Suzanne Anderson from Fruit Heights, Utah. Hi, Suzanne. How are you?
I'm great, Fish.
Great to have you on the show, and I'm excited because, as you know, we always like to have people on who have had amazing journeys of discovery. We'd like to hear how you did it, what you found, and the stories are always incredible. Now, what line were you working on?
Well, since I didn't have a whole lot to do on my line, I decided to pick my husband's line, which goes back to Germans that lived in Russia.
Ooh, boy, that's tough stuff.
Very much so. I thought that it was going to be really easy, and so I joined the Germans from Russia Association, and I bought 3 very large books, The Immigration from Germany into Russia, that was written by Carl Stump. And I was convinced that I would find the information. And I was looking for the surname Dorr, D-O umlaut R-R, or in America it's D-O-E-R-R.
Right.
Or Raab, R-A-A-B. And
That's complicated, and that's good for people to know that there are variant spellings based on the foreign names that we have to look for.
What I found was that when I got into the immigration records, I found that the people who took down the information spelled the names exactly how they sounded.
That's a good lesson, isn't it?
Yes. Let me start with my husband's grandfather, Levine Dorr. And he would always say, when we would ask him questions, he would say, "What is in the past stays in the past."
Ooh.
We are in America now, and we are proud to be Americans. And we used to think that he just simply was being a little bit ornery and didn't want to talk to us. But through the years, we have realized that the information was just too painful for him to talk about. Because two brothers and three nephews were all that came to America. And on his grandmother's side, his grandmother and her father came. And the rest of the family stayed there. And then the Bolsheviks came in, and it was impossible to get them out. On his grandmother's side, the Robb side, her mother, a brother, and two small sisters starved to death before they could get them out.
And these are the stories that are so challenging to find. Now, yeah, you got this from where? Where did you get that information?
Piecemeal from the family. His grandmother would talk a little bit more, and she had contact with a sister that married and was either sent to Siberia or they moved to Siberia. And then when her father died, his death certificate says that the other members of the family were deceased. When the Bolsheviks came in, they took the men into the service. They destroyed the fields and homes and cemeteries and burned most of the records. So what records may be there, some of them we're still searching for.
But this is a good lesson in the idea of, you want to get the background of what was happening in the area where your people were to put together their history even without them telling you.
Well, I had written that down, too, that one of the things that you need to understand is what was going on in the country, and you can glean information from that. What are the hidden clues in that history and the dynamics of the German-Russian people? See, the Germans came into Russia at the time of Catherine the Great in the 1700s. She was German. She promised them land, no taxes. The men did not have to serve in the military. And it was later, when things began to fall apart, that they came in and began to demand and to destroy.
That sounds kind of like what they did with the Huguenots back in the day.
Right, right. And see, Lou's grandmother would say, "I am not Russian. I am German." Because they lived in very cloistered German communities along the Volga River. It was a totally Lutheran community. There were others that were Catholic or Mennonite, but they didn't do much mixing. So these things are really important to understand the history, what was going on, and the closeness of the families.
Yeah, so even if you don't get stories necessarily from grandpa and grandma or whatever was passed down, you can kind of superimpose their lives into this setting.
Right. Now, the one thing that I, when I finally got my acting gear and realized I was looking for something I wasn't going to find because I needed to come to this day and time, I spent hours looking for information in the family history library, and finally, after a day of going through immigration records, because I had no idea what port they came into, or really even the year, and I finally found them, and I literally stood up and cheered because it was such a find.
Yes.
And those immigration records are such an important thing to give you all of these clues. You know, where are they going? And one of the things that we found was that his grandfather was going to a John Dorr. We thought it was his older brother. But years later, we found when Grandpa died, he had a piece of paper in his wallet that called this John Dorr his half-brother. And then we found out later by talking to some people that when they said half-brother, that was like we say a cousin.
Interesting.
And through that, when we talked to someone in Sheboygan, Michigan, we found out that her husband was in that half-brother category to our grandfather. And she gave us the maiden name of Lou's grandfather's mother, which we did not have, Alberti.
Wow, what a great find.
And then Lou got interested, and he started making contact with some people, family names, up in Michigan, because they all went to Port Huron. And he started calling around, and he ran down an older woman. In fact, she was in her 90s, that come to find out she knew Lou's grandmother and grandfather in Russia.
You've got to be kidding me. And, what a great find that is.
And so she gave us information. Plus, she sent us a picture of this big, beautiful church where they all went to church.
Did you stand up and cheer again?
I did. We did. Everything we find is just amazing. One of the problems, too, that we've had is that Grandpa came into the port on the coast, came into Baltimore, went to Cleveland, and then we lost track of him because he wasn't any place when they took the census records. And so we had a hard time tracing him to Port Huron. And then when we found him and knew that grandmother was there, then I wrote to the Lutheran churches there and finally found marriage records.
Boy, you really went to town on this, didn't you? And all these things, though, I would imagine some of these records helped get you back into specific places in Russia, yes?
Yes. Stump's book clarified that they lived in a village that was called Kent, but it's spelled K-I-N-D, but it's Kent.
Right.
And the Russians came in and renamed it, so we were able to get the Russian name of the town also.
Now, as things have changed over the years politically, have you been able to go back and go to this place?
No, we have not gone, but we know someone who did, and there's no town there. There's nothing.
Ooh.
Because the Bolsheviks just came in, and the church is a shell that was used to house the cattle and the horses. And the cemetery, there are no markings and no records as to who's buried there.
Boy, that's got to bring you some sadness.
It really does. And I think the important thing, Scott, is that what we do know is that they made huge sacrifices to come. And we wonder what would have happened to that part of the family if they had not made that sacrifice. And they literally said goodbye to their parents and their family, turned around and walked away and never saw the family again. And they were so proud that they were Americans.
Thank you so much, Suzanne.
You're certainly welcome, Scott.
And coming up next, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our preservation authority. Got an interesting email from a listener. We'll share it with you coming up in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with the newlywed Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com.
Does this mean I lose my fan club now?
You are off the market, Tom. You're breaking hearts across the land.
That's right.
Anyway, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It was an exciting day. And today we have a question from St. Louis, Missouri, from Linda Dartmouth. And she says, Tom, love the thing about the tests on the camcorders being thrown out of a Ferrari at 100 miles an hour last week. She says, number one, I don't need a camcorder that can survive that. Number two, were you driving the Ferrari?
Boy, I so wish. That is my dream. I'd love to have taken that around a test track.
She wants to know if there are some other types of camcorders she should be aware of other than that.
Yeah, there's some great ones that you don't need to throw out of a Ferrari at 100 miles an hour. The first one I'm going to tell you about, well, first off, let me tell you, get a copy of the latest. It's the August 2014 of Consumer Reports. And on page 43, they have four really good camcorders I'm going to tell you about that are really, really good. One they call is a Best Buy. These are great cameras. They're high definition. They're less expensive. You don't want to throw them out of a Ferrari or even your Fiesta, probably even 10 miles an hour. But they're good cameras and they're good pricing. The first one is called a Sony HDR CX240. It's only $230. And it's a Best Buy. And it has what they call a 27 optical zoom lens. Now, what you need to understand, which a lot of people get confused,
right,
between the zoom lens and the optical lens. An optical lens is true optics. And so if you're at 27%, which this says it's going to bring anything that's 27 times farther away from you right up, and it's going to look great. Now, a zoom lens or a digital zoom is not very good. And to me, they're pretty much garbage unless you're watching an airplane crash and you want to stay far away, but you want to be able to get it in so you can put it on the news and see your name as a byline.
So how does that work? What's the difference?
What it does is it just takes the pixels and enlarges them, just like you can do yourself in Photoshop. So I suggest if you have something like that, put it in Photoshop and blow it up. That's for something that you really want to get, but you don't care about the quality. It's just so far away, like maybe a nesting eagle. So you have something, but it's not good quality. And optical is what's really, really important, and that's what you need to pay attention to. And like I mentioned, this one has a 27 optical zoom lens. It's only $203. Or if you want to go up to the next one, Sony has another HDR, which is called a CX330, which is $100 more, so it's $330. And it has a 30 times optical lens, so it's a little bit better. But the neat thing about this one, it's Wi-Fi.
Ooh. Now, this means you can then send this stuff after you shoot it, right?
Oh, exactly. So it's great if you're like at a family reunion or at a wedding like I was last week, and somebody is shooting with one of these Wi-Fi camcorders. If you have your laptop there, they can instantly download it. No wires, no USB 3, no high-definition FireWire, nothing. It's totally over the waves. Another neat thing about this camera is the battery life. This one will go up to 180 minutes, and that's something you want to check into.
Wow.
Because a lot of people don't buy two batteries. They get out there at Disneyland, and all of a sudden their battery dies.
Yeah, 3 hours worth. That's incredible.
Boy, oh, it
these
is.
Things are improving, aren't they?
Oh, it's amazing. They're getting smaller. They last longer. They take less time to recharge, and the price is coming down. It's just like, you know, I wish the Ferrari would do that.
You know, I'm so happy now that you're a married man, Tom, that your wife Sharon has actually allowed you to come and play.
Oh, I know. It's just like, it's so different. I didn't know she'd let me out today.
All right. We were talking about camcorders a few minutes ago, and you mentioned something about a camcorder we can now take out if we were to go snorkeling.
Absolutely. And then a little teaser, I'm going to tell you about something before that, about another camera that's amazing. Now, these are also in the 2014 August edition of Consumer Reports. There's a Panasonic HC-V550 that's about $400 that has a 50 times optical lens.
Whoa.
So if you go to a lot of national parks, you go to places and do bird watching, eagles, this is a great camera because optically they will bring them right into you and the footage will be amazing. It's high definition. It'll look great. Forget about any of the zoom capabilities. And this one also has Wi-Fi. And two other cool things about it, it has what's called advanced level shot function.
What does that mean?
That means it takes a horizon and straightens it out. So if you're leaning a little to your right or a little to your left, it'll straighten it out for you.
So you have a shorter leg on one side than the other?
Let's not get into eye-lean.
Okay, right.
And another thing it has is a 5-axis image stabilization. So if you're driving your motorcycle or riding a bicycle and you want it to be able to get a better image, this has a 5-axis image stabilization that somehow goes out and says, okay, this should be here, this should be here, this should be here. This isn't here. I'm going to pull it back and make it there.
Wow.
So it's just amazing. And that's only like $400 for this high definition
camera. Isn't that amazing? You remember what beta players cost back in the 70s? They were like $1,200, $1,500.
They were. When they first came out, they were that. My 3-chip camera that I told you about last week, I paid $1,500 for it and it wasn't high definition.
Look at this. It's
just crazy. It's crazy. And what's cooler than a camcorder you can take snorkeling?
Tell me about this.
This is incredible. It's not water resistant. It is actually waterproof. And it's a JVC GZR700. And the amazing thing is it's only $500.
That's great. Now, how deep can you go with this thing?
You know, I don't know exactly how deep. In the Consumer Reports, they said they took it down to 16 feet and it worked fine. 16 feet. When you're snorkeling, you usually don't go below 16 feet anyway.
That's right. If you go scuba diving, at least 20.
Right.
And then 30 and more.
Right.
So you wouldn't take it for this.
Exactly. You can get housings and things like this. But this is one you can take on a cruise with you or on your trip to California and you're out shooting the family on the beach. You walk right into the surf with it.
That is amazing. Now, what is the name of this one?
This is called the JVC GZR70, and it has this, like I say, it's waterproof for shooting underwater. And even though you think, well, I'm not going to go snorkeling, if you shoot a lot at the beach, you don't have to worry about the sand blowing into it. You don't have to worry about the ocean spray. And one thing, if you do take it to the ocean, I recommend when you do get home, get some distilled water, pour on the camera, get the salt off of it so it's not going to, you know, mess up your lens by having the film on it. So it's easy to take care of. And this has a, are you ready, a 40 times optical zoom lens.
So we can do this underwater now. I mean, these are places we've never been able to take video cameras before.
Oh, absolutely. And it's amazing. You can shoot the octopus, the starfish, and push on out really, really tight. And it's incredible to take that up and watch on your high definition television, this huge starfish that you saw with your own eyes and maybe even handled.
Now, does this come with Wi-Fi?
Yes, that one also comes with Wi-Fi. So I guess if you had a good enough Wi-Fi, you could actually set it up through the water. I've never tried using my iPhone underwater, so I don't know if Wi-Fi works underwater or not.
Oh, this is insane stuff. I love it. That is why you are the preservation authority. He's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. And of course, if you have any questions for him, you can always ask Tom at TMCPlace.com. Thanks for seeing us, Tom.
It's great to be back.
And thanks, Sharon, for loaning him to us. Also, thanks to Craig Scott from Heritage Books for coming on and sharing with us how to find your revolutionary soldiers and track down their service records. Great stuff. If you didn't catch it, listen to the podcast later this week on iTunes and iHeartRadio. And remember, you can now download our free app for listening to podcasts on your iPhones and Androids. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week for our first anniversary show. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.